This is Bob Brundage. The date is June the 27th, 1996. We're at the 45th National Square Dance Convention in San Antonio. And tonight we're talking with Cal Campbell from Castle Rock, Colorado. And we're very interested in hearing Cal's life story. So, Cal, give it all you got.
Life story as far as for dance, right?
Right, and before, whatever.
Well, I started out dancing pretty young. My dad danced, my mother danced. In fact, they both met at the dance. So when I was growing up, we used to go to the local dance in town. We lived in a little one-horse town on the western slope of Colorado by the name of Rifle. And every Saturday night, there was a dance someplace within at least driving radius. Not too much else to do, so everybody went to the dance. And when we were little bitty kids, we stayed out in the car. We could come in once in a while and dance. We could, you know, usually the parents would bring us in for the square dance part. Most of it was, you know, couple dancing, belly rubbing dances, we used to call it, bell puzzle, spology. But there was always square dance part of the night. They always did a Varsity Vienna, always did a Virginia Reel, and always did a visiting couple square. Which was a lot of fun. About the time I was in the fourth grade, we had a teacher that was going to teach us all how to square dance. So we got out, square dance. It was fun. It was a good experience. It wasn't something that, like some of the kids go through today, where it was miserable. She knew what she was doing. We square danced. We square danced off and on through high school, but most of the time, square dancing was just a subset of the local dance. We'd have a dance go on all night long sometimes, and we'd have a square dance tip someplace in the middle, and all us kids would dance. The big thing then was the swing and foxtrot, what we used to call the waltz. It wasn't the waltz really, it's what Pappy used to call the fool's waltz. But we'd dance, and we'd rather dance than eat. That was main entertainment. Kept us out of a lot of fights. You know, coming from a small town, we had a tendency every once in a while to get in trouble. We had a principal that had a little three-piece band. Every time we decided we were going to go up and raise Cain with the little town up the way, he'd come up with a dance, and that just put the kibosh on it, because we'd rather dance than eat. About the time I got into college, the square dance club at the college level up at Colorado A&M, it was the second largest club on campus. It was the place with the most single girls and the most guys that didn't want to be attached to any girl. It was a good place to go just to meet girls. Dancing was largely, you didn't learn it in terms of any sort of lessons. You just got out on the floor and you got in position four, as we did in those days. And you started learning how to dance. When it got to your position on the floor, you knew what to do. This is about 1955. Square dancing at that point in time was really starting to roll. And by the time I had been to school about 3 or 4 years, we were into probably the hash calling era very seriously. It started, I know, a lot earlier than that, but it was getting to the stage where we had about 50, 55 terms that we could learn, and it was rolling along real good. And the college club, once again, was the second largest club on the campus. We'd have an average of 10 to 12 squares of kids out there dancing every week. Lessons were short at that point in time. I think one time we were really shocked about the fact that we had to have 10 lessons in order to get the people to know all these terms. College Square Dance Club had two things that were big events for us. Number one, they had an exhibition team. And I learned, oh golly, within a few months after I got into school, that square dancing was all right, but the callers had the edge. And if you really wanted to meet the young ladies, that you need to get up there on the mic. And that was probably my primary motivation for becoming a caller. It's kind of embarrassing to admit that now, but you know, my big thing was, I figured, well, if I got up on the mic and learned how to call the dance, then that gave me a better chance to meet some other young ladies. It really worked. know, from the standpoint that Judy's in the room with us, and I was calling a dance one night for the Aggie Haylockers, the name of the club. She came walking up to me and says, "I bet you don't know who I am." And I said, "No, I haven't got a clue." She says, "Well, I'm sister of Phyllis, and Phyllis was on our exhibition team. And her husband had just gotten married when I was on our exhibition team, right now?" Mm-hmm. Okay. The exhibition team at CSU, when I first got there and joined the exhibition, danced 1 year on it. And that was my sophomore year, I guess it was in college. And at that point in time, we had enough kids for two squares. And so we got to experimenting with the two squares. We decided, gee, it'd be fun if we put eight couples in a set. And we had no idea what to call it at that point in time, except it was fun to do. And so I was the caller at that point in time, and we had a couple other people dancing on the team that were quite good, and we started inventing some figures that we could do in this eight-couple set. And so for the next 3 or 4 years, I went to vet school, which meant I had to go to school more than 4 years. In fact, I ended up going seven to get out. But for the next several years, we danced in this royal set. Now, we're talking about the period of 1955, 56, 57. Okay, in 1957, they were going to have a centennial or a sesquicentennial celebration for Denver. And Mrs. Shaw, Pappy Shaw just died, and Mrs. Shaw was helping and putting on a pageant for this centennial celebration down in Denver. And she had a part of that she wanted to do called a Lancers, a Royal Lancers, which was done eight couples to the set. And so Mrs. Shaw came up to Fort Collins, and I don't remember who referred it, but she came in and she said, "Talk to the exhibition team and said, would you like to do this part?" And my, she was a wonderful lady. And so the part, we didn't know nothing about it. I mean, we were just square dancers. We didn't do anything except in squares. We did this fancy precision stuff in an eight-couple set. Ms. Shaw came in. The fact that it was a kind of a new thing that she wanted to do that really nobody else in the United States was doing at that time, it required research. She did the research. I got to work with her quite a bit. The music, we had no idea what the music was like, so Mrs. Shaw did the research on the music. She located a band or something that would play music of that style. And we learned how to do the Royal Lancers. The band had just purchased some fancy new uniforms. And I located, I remember, a swallowtail coat that I could wear that 1 year. I was never skinny enough to wear it again. Grew mutton chop whiskers, the ones that come down around your chin. And we went down and did that convention and did that show twice. The thing that was really amazing to me was the fact that this was my first exposure to all this other kind of dancing. Up until that time, I was a square dancer, I was a square dance caller. And there we were in this room with all these other people. And I think probably the thing that I remember the most, that made the most impact, there's a great huge gold nugget that they had hung up in the middle of this display, or in the arena. And it's showing up there in the darkness, and Dina and Alan Fresh were in their full colonial costumes doing the Oxford Minuet. Remember that? Doing the Oxford Minuet. And I looked at that, and that was a totally different form of dance, and very lovely, and very elegant. And I loved it. I thought it was great. Chuck Jones, at that point in time, was the MC. Chuck Jones stood up there when we got done with our portion of it. He said, "You know, there are a lot of things that we say about the kids that's not good, just like we say it today. But," he says, "you know," he says, "that bunch of kids going to turn out all right." And I think it made a big impression on me, and I think it made a big impression on a lot of other kids. That was our introduction to Mrs. Shaw. after that, two or three of us asked permission to come down and see if we couldn't dance with her at a little old swing club on Monday night. And we would crawl in the car and we would drive from Fort Collins down to the dance in Colorado Springs, dance with the swing club until they got done, go up to the house, listen to Mrs. Shaw tell stories and philosophize, and then drive back. We never stayed overnight. Okay, now think about the fact that's the days when we had two-lane roads. They had an old 1948 Chevrolet, which was pretty good when you consider the fact this is 55, 56, 57, 58. It would be about 9, 10 years old. We'd go down there and drive back. I remember one time going down there. It was snowing, and we decided to go anyway. And we pulled up in the driveway. Mrs. Shaw's little hall would hold maybe three squares, had these little small windows in it. And as we came up the driveway, we parked down below and hiked up. The snow was coming down and drifting down, and we could see the dancers inside the hall. And there wasn't a shoulder that was bouncing one inch. It was that smooth dancing. It was just incredible. Back up a little bit for the college. The other event that the college had, which really helped keep the club together and made it something exciting to be in, is we held a festival every year. And the festival at that point in time would draw 100 squares for two nights of dancing. There was no gymnasium up there that would hold not much more than that, and we would cram it full. The only time we ever met Pappy was up there. And my picture of Pappy Shaw was this old gentleman up on the stage with the two canes, standing there talking with that voice that just filled the hall. The man was incredible, the speaker. And he would come up on the stage and he would talk and they'd introduce him and he would say something and then we'd go on with the dance. But that was the only time I ever met him. It was still quite an experience. The exhibition team. After we once had gone through this period where we had learned the Lancers, we became quite fascinated with these old dances. And the band had bought new uniforms, so we would borrow the uniforms every once in a while, and these were the uniforms with the tight-fitted waistcoats, and the girls would make the long dresses. And we would do the Royal Lancers, we would do the exhibition figures in the set of eight. And a couple times we got to travel. I remember one trip, we were invited to some big festival at the Exarban Coliseum in Omaha, Nebraska.
Mm-hmm. I've called there.
Called there? Great, big, huge hall.
300 squares.
And it must have been a big enough festival. It may have been a national, I don't remember. But it may have been a national because they were taking a train to go from Denver to Omaha and back, and we went on the train with the people, and all of us kids stayed out at a university out there, one of the Christian universities. They had grounds that sloped down into a pond, and we would go dance, and we were, of course, part of the exhibitions. And the hall was so big that when we were out in the center of it doing our exhibition, and I had a mic, there was a delay between what I was calling and what they were hearing. Probably close to a second and a half. Huge place. And of course, these people were just filled and the joint was packed. We'd go back and we would go to the after parties after we got done. The after parties would eventually spill out in the streets. Omaha police were wonderful. They finally just blocked off the end of a couple of blocks and let the dancers dance. We would get done with that, and we would go back out to where the university was, and we would dance some more. And then you would go home, or you'd go back up to your room and go to bed for maybe 2 hours, and then get back and go again. And this was dancing. Of course, we were young. We danced in the pond out there, which I'm sure the police would have been very upset about if we'd done it today. We danced in our pajamas. You know, those were the days when you had all the fun badges. We danced in our pajamas, and after 3 or 4 days of this, 3 days, I guess it was a national festival, But Carl called on the train to go back. We danced in the cars. We stuffed the bathroom with people. Those are the days when they were stuffing Volkswagens and stuffing telephone booths.
Yeah, phone booths. Yeah.
So we decided to stuff a Pullman booth. Had a great time. We got back, and this was right at the end of school. And the next thing I had when I got back off this trip is I had a job. And my job was working for Town Talk Bread Company. And I was supposed to go out and work with a driver for 3 or 4 days, and then I was going to replace him for 2 or 3 weeks that he was on vacation. Okay, I'd gone probably 3 nights with 6 hours sleep total. We had partied all the way back on this train. Had a wonderful time. We got back in, and I had to report for work. The train pulled in about 6, and I had to report for work at 9. So I went straight from the train out to where I was supposed to go to work. The driver, when I got there, he said, Cal, you were comical. He says, I would hand you a tray of bread that we carry in. And he said, follow me inside, and I'd walk inside, and I would just stand there with the tray in my hand. He'd say, put it down, and I would just stand there like a zombie. And finally he would say, put it down, and I would put it down, and then we'd go back and do this 2 or 3, 4 times. He said, if you hadn't told me what you'd done the last several days, he'd been fired right there. It was fun. It was lots of fun. At CSU, I went to veterinary school up there. It took me 7 years to finish out the doctor's degree, and I called for the exhibition 6 out of the 7 years for the exhibition team. Tremendous experience, lots of fun. Met lots of people, met Judy, we got married. A lot of the couples that we have known since then, we met in college. That's where we gained our enthusiasm. This is where I think square dancing will rejuvenate itself is among the college kids. And if we can build that generation, we can go from there. From there, went into to the Army. This was the days of the draft, and they wanted to draft me immediately after college. And I had a veterinary degree, so they took me into the Army and went to El Paso, Texas. And went into training, actually ended up down here in San Antonio to start with. And then went from there to Chicago, and then from there to El Paso, Texas. We called in El Paso, or I called in El Paso. I don't recall we had a club. I just called. Did we have a club?
I don't think we ever had a formal club, but I know we started out dancing. We had a vacant shop in a shopping center, and that's where we met and had our first set of lessons down there.
Mm-hmm.
It was in that vacant storefront.
Yeah, that's right.
Paso.
Yeah. And there we went, after a couple of years in the Army, we went up to Santa Fe, New Mexico. And I was in Santa Fe, New Mexico from 1964 through 1968. We started a club up there by the name of Alleman Leftovers, which survived for almost 20-some years, long after we left. During that period of time, we got very involved with the local square dance organizations, the state organization. I was state president 1 year, put on the festival, which was the president's job at that point in time. Had a grand group up at Santa Fe. Square dancing at that point in time was very social. The dancing really was quite good, quite smooth. Between 62, 63, 64, the ladies had these big beehive hairdos. And we were down one time dancing in the old church that we danced in. And we did a figure with a dive-through from the outside. Lady hooked her beehive hairdo on somebody's watch band, these little expandable type watch bands, yanked it right off her head. I met Poncho Bear, got to know him. There were a couple other callers who were down and were retired down in Santa Fe that I had a chance to talk to. Good callers, good dancing. The dancing, this is where I found out that one of the places where dancing had pretty much stayed alive was in the areas in New Mexico. And this is where I eventually met Herb Gregerson, and went down and visited with him several times to learn about what dancing was happening there.
He was in Rio Doso.
He lived in Rio Doso. Yeah. He had a lodge down there that was absolutely crammed with old musical players, the old big plate players that played the pin.
The cylinder players.
The cylinder players. Yeah,
I've heard that, yes.
And at that point in time, he had Alzheimer's very bad. But Pauline was able to sit around and tell us a lot of stories about the age and the time and what had gone on there. In 1969, they sent Judy and I out to California to go to another year of school. I've always kidded about the fact I didn't learn it right the first time, so I had to go for a retread job. And they sent me out to graduate school at Sacramento. Actually, Davis, the town that had the university. We lived in a little town called Dixon, but we went into Davis to dance with Lee Helsel's Highwaymen. First exposure to ever to recording, because one time Lee invited us to come on down to a hall, or come on down to the recording studio where he recorded a record, in the, which I thought was fascinating. Highwaymen was Lee's club. It existed for probably 30 plus years. Very, very good dancers. Lee, of course, was an excellent caller, and out there we mostly danced. I did a little calling, but mostly danced. This was the place where Judy, we were starting in the Lord Shaw Foundation to put together a set of records for elementary dancing. And Judy took the set over to the school. You just want to tell them a little bit about this.
This was back when they were beginning to develop the elementary kit. And what we had then, instead of having a nice, neat little kit with 45 records in it, we had 33 and a thirds, we had 78s, we had 45s, and we had this totally mismatched stack. So I thought, well, it's a good chance to try out all of these different dances. So I went to the local elementary school there in Dixon, and I said, could I come in and teach some of your classes just once in a while and work through these dances and help you out and help me out? They came back to me a few days later and said, we have it set up for you to teach all of the elementary school children here in Dixon on this regular basis. So it ended up being a full-time volunteer job for a while. But I got to call and teach all of the elementary children in Dixon, Colorado, and try out the kit and see how well it worked and how well it danced. And it was wonderful, because no matter where we went in the little town, all the children knew me. You know, that's the dance lady. That's the lady that taught us how to dance. So it was a real good chance to try out the kit and learn with the children, because I had never done it before. So it was like, pick up the record, listen to it, figure out the dance, then go teach the kids. So it was a great opportunity. And we had been members ever since college of the Lloyd Shaw Fellowship, because you really need to backtrack and tell them the story of being involved. Because through all these travels and trips, even when we lived in Santa Fe and El Paso, we were commuting back and forth once a year to attend the summer school that Dorothy Shaw was teaching in Colorado Springs. And that's the way we got involved.
Probably ought to back a little bit.
I think so.
I graduated in 1962. Judy and I had been married a year. And they were fixing to ship me out to the Army down for the training down here in San Antonio. We'd been going to Mrs. Shaw's little swing club. By that time, Judy, once we got married, Judy was coming along once in a while. But I was in vet school, and the time to spare to do much of any sort of traveling was zip. Apparently, about this point in time, Mrs. Shaw had decided that the group that had met after Pappy's death was rather old. I mean, they're my age now. Was rather old, and she had decided that this group needed to have an influx of some young people. And we had no idea at that point in time. In fact, we didn't have any idea for several years. But there were a few people that Mrs. Shaw decided to experiment with. And the first couple were a couple by the name of Gibb and Carla Gilbert, who were married at that point in time. The second couple were Judy and I. And then, you know, we were the first two experimental, I guess, kids. There were a couple other, John and Linda Bradford were a couple that were young at that point in time, but they had been kind of grandfathered in by means of one of the other ladies that was there by the name of Mary Jo Bradford. But they decided to experiment. So Carl and Gibb came the year ahead of us, and we came the next year, 1962. We arrived terrified. I mean, not just a little bit terrified. I mean, mm-hmm. really terrified. Because there was Bob Osgood, and there was Dina and Ellen Frisch, and there were all of these people that we had heard about. And they were there dancing. And we were young college kids, and we didn't know nothing. I can't really say I knew how to waltz. I was certainly a very mediocre square dance caller. You know, I'd survived fine in college, but as far as for knowing anything, well, I didn't. And the people were wonderful. We were absolutely in seventh heaven during that week. You know, they opened up and they put their arms around us and they taught us how to sing. Bob Howe was there. We got a huge charge out of his night that he did, and it was great. And we got invited back. We didn't know we were on trial.
It's probably a good thing.
Which is probably a good thing. I mean, we were scared enough as it was. I can remember we were trying to learn how to waltz. And Dana Fresh was there, and Carlotta Hagerman were there, and they danced like angels. And I felt like a clod. Judy felt like a clod, and Dina decided to take me on the floor to show me something. I was so scared I couldn't move. We've laughed about that many years since, because since then I have never become what I would call a graceful waltzer, but I've gotten to a place where I can waltz all right. But I was scared. I was so terrified I couldn't move. We went back every year that it was held after that for 17 years. It provided us with the breadth of knowledge that we couldn't have gotten any other way. And I've often told people that's one of the reasons we work so hard to try and pass it on. It's the fact that we got so much from those people that was freely given without any reservation whatsoever, that you ended up in a position where you felt that you had to somehow try and figure out a way to pass it on. 1976, because of that, the convention people out in California, we were putting on that bicentennial convention. And about 2 years ahead of that, they came in and were asking, they sent a couple of representatives to the fellowship to talk to them about, we want to do a pageant. I mean, this is a bicentennial, we should do a pageant. And so part of it, they got to talking to Judy and I, and they asked us if we would be the historical consultants. And at that point in time, I can't really say that I knew a lot about history. But we became the historical consultants. We spent a lot of the next 2 years doing research, helping them research dancing with the people in the fellowship. And, you know, that much more knowledge coming at us. And helping them find groups of people who could do things that weren't a part of the fellowship but were part of square dancing. And getting introduced to a lot of people that we come back and are friends now. You know, Stu Shacklett was part of that group. A lot of the people who do what I would call the old time dancing were part of that group. But through this, we became acquaintances with it. The net result, once we got to talking about how to put on the pageant, and they were having a terrible time trying to come up with some way to be able to display the dancers so that all the people in this big arena could see them. And so we set up the arena in Anaheim with all these candles outlining it. It looked like the United States. And then in each of the dances that went on, you went to the point in the United States that was important for that part of the dance, which meant that the people were in a very large arena, but there was something going on that was close to them every once in a while. This presented a problem from the standpoint of how do you hook the pieces together. So someone came back and said, okay, we'll do this idea if you and Judy will be the MCs. And once again, I think probably this struck terror into our hearts. But we did, and what we did was basically Judy and I were the transition points as we would go from point to point, we would walk, the spotlights would follow us, and we would read a script, and then the next piece of dance would go on, and then the lights would go down on them, come spotlight come back on us, and we'd move to the next one. We were kind of the wandering minstrel, I guess is what you'd call it. And so it was just a way of being able to do it that pulled the whole thing together. The other thing that happened, this is really where we got interested in what Herb Gregerson had done. Because we were in the Southwest, Herb Gregerson had his blue bonnet set. And so we went down and spent, I would say, probably several weekends working with Pauline, going through the dances that they had done during that era. And there were some fantastic figures, figures we've lost. I mean, the traditional people haven't picked them up, Bob, and the modern square dancer can't do them because the language doesn't fit. But there were figures that were done during a period of time between probably 1948, when hash calling really started to come into being, and Gregerson started that whole thing, and about 1955, when the language stabilized, with this kind of set of terms that we're using that period of time. But there were a lot of figures that were done during that period of time that are gone. And they're gone because there's no way to call them with the modern terminology and nobody else has picked them up. Herb's blue bonnet set did a bunch of these things. We went down, Pauline got out the old pictures for us of what the dresses looked like. She got out the dress patterns that she had stuck in back of the drawer. And we made these polka dot, what is it, Swiss? Donna Swiss?
Donna Swiss with Chet Gingham.
Okay. Dresses. Her dress weighed how much?
15 pounds.
15 pounds is what her dress weighed. It was the dress that went all the way down to your ankles, and Judy could take the two ends and hold them up over the top of her head without raising the other material 1 foot, 1 inch off the floor.
Right.
Tremendously heavy dresses. And we did Herb Gregerson's blue bonnet set at the Anaheim Festival. That pageant played to 6,500 people. It was a pack on the house. They ran it twice. There was such a huge demand for tickets, they ran it a third time. We could have done it four times. At the time when I think the national convention that year was the biggest convention, it was 39,000. And we could have done probably five shows. We could have had three quarters of the people who were willing to come through and see that show.
They figured over 20,000 saw it.
Yeah, over half the convention saw it. Great. Fun. We pulled a lot of the dance and a lot of the history off of the material Mrs. Shaw had done for the 58 convention. You know, this was our base to work off of. That one was not filmed. The one at Anaheim was filmed. And so we've got an archive on that.
And Dorothy Shaw was there.
Mrs. Shaw was there. She spoke to the crowd. We had a lot of elegant dances that went on that. I won't say it was better in the 1958 because I don't think there's any way to compare. You know, they were two different flavors of things, but they were both a great recording of history about what went on, a lot of it very authentic. The Calico and Boots dancers did Pappy Shaw's part. Did a glorious part. It was just tremendous to watch them. They did all the aerial figures. It was really something. At that point in time, we were back living in New Mexico. I'd gone to graduate school. We came back. Back then, I thought I was going to be a real good caller. Have no idea whether I was or not, but I was calling about 200 plus nights a year and called for four clubs. Mainstream was in full flower. We had very little plus dancing, although that was coming along about that point in time. I got invited to 1974, got invited to the first meeting of Caller Lab. Once again, I went. It was considerably odd because here were all these famous people that I had heard about, and I got a chance to meet, sit down and talk with. Became very active in Caller Lab. With the background that I had from listening to Mrs. Shaw and all these other folks, I had been taught timing to the place of where it was an absolute essential core of my square dancing and my calling. And so I fought hard for it. I fought for styling, you know, all the things that went on. We went back 1980, we moved up to Fort Collins, Colorado. I changed jobs. I went into a job that was extremely demanding, and basically Colleen had to take a back seat. And Colleen had to take a back seat for almost 5 years. And when we got done with it, I called some. We used to go out to, I called around Fort Collins. We never had a club. I called around Fort Collins, and we used to go out. Judy would pick me up at the airport. We'd go out to Sterling, which is outside of Denver, probably 80, 90 miles.
Fort Morgan
and those areas, and call and come back. Changed jobs again in 85, and frankly, I was burnt out. You know, I'd been calling 200 nights a month. I'd gone into a high-pressure job. I was in middle management, and I honestly tried to retire. We were going to continue with the Lloyd Shaw Foundation to dance. We were going to dance, but I wasn't going to call. That lasted how long?
3 years.
You know, I did one night stands and stuff like that, but I just basically burned out. So we got back into it. I had dropped out of Collar Lab. I rejoined Collar Lab and started calling around the city some more, and finally deciding that I wanted to do some more mainstream calling. And I still had lots of the one night stand things, parties and things like that. About that time, we were doing quite a bit with dancing in a simpler form, and they called up and said, would you come to Collar Lab to do a session showing what you're doing? I had proposed to the Lloyd Shaw Foundation that we hold a leadership training institute. And the purpose of the institute was to come up with some dances in a dance form that would be acceptable to college students. Because I felt that if we did not have a younger group of dancers coming up behind us, it was going to die. And so we put together what was termed the Leadership Training Institute. I think Don Armstrong really named the institute. He's the one who came up with the name. And he and I and Bill Litchman, Judy and Chris, and Ruth Ann Knapp were the core people who went down and put on the first Leadership Training Institute. And it was one of those things that kind of evolved. It didn't really involve the direction I thought it should evolve at first, but it evolved. In other words, I had an idea that this would be a place where we would train new young dancers, and we would all get together and talk about exchange dances, not in the same context as we did at the fellowship dances, but in an environment similar to this, to where we exchange ideas. As it turned out, it became a training ground to where four of us were on staff and the students came in. This lasted basically, 4 years? We held 4 years of the training institute. We put 130-some people through it. It did a lot of good. But it was one of those things that evolves with time to the place of where it no longer works. And so we stopped it. About that point in time, Collar Lab said, come and let's try out, come do a session at Collar Lab doing the same sort of thing. Well, in the meantime, Ken Kernan and Bob Osgood as the primary drivers, plus a committee of probably, I don't know, probably 20 people, had gotten together and put together the community dance program. And I guess if I had to put together my own program, I'd make some small changes. But basically, it was a good, solid program. It included all the elements that Judy and I liked. We could square dance, we could contra dance, we had trios, we had quadrilles, we had mescalances, we had mixers, we had Sicilian circles, we had all the stuff we wanted. Growing up in the environment around Mrs. Shaw and the fellowship, we got to a place where we liked hornpipes and jigs and reels and singing calls and all of this broad range of music that we liked and the different types and styles of dancing that were there. The only thing that the community dance program didn't have the broad range of terms. Okay, this fit, to me, fit the image of how I learned. Here's something that we could learn in 6 or 8 weeks. This is something that people could do for a lifetime. It was very socially oriented. from the standpoint of this is what square dancing used to be like, a very social environment. The only thing was that we wanted to live within 24 terms. Okay, why 24 terms? This allowed people to have a common language like we used to have back in the 50s when we had 55 terms. And we felt that if we could agree among leaders to go out and teach this limited set, that we could use this as the core to be able to build on forever. And I think it still will work. I really do. In probably the last 4 years, we spent 90% of our dancing effort in the community dance program. I still do a lot of one-night stands. I still call 10 or 12 mainstream dances a year. I probably do 20, 25 parties a year, and we do the community dance program. It's been fun. I guess, for the purposes of archive, that if I have any regrets, it's the fact that I don't think that mainstream square dancing will survive, that whatever evolves will evolve, but it's not going to include mainstream square dance calling. I think that we will return to a style of dancing that will be a lot smoother than what we have at the present time. At least I hope so. I'm not ready to quit that badly yet. If we can get back to what I would say are simpler roots, you know, one of the things Mrs. Shaw pointed out when she would talk to us is the fact that all dancing has evolved from the simple to the very complex, and then the people get tired of the complex and it goes back to the simple. And I think if we're any place in that cycle, that's where it is.
Well, that's great. Now, tell us about dancing for busy people.
I'm a writer, I think. At least I'm a wordsmith. One of the things that I can do a lot of good communication that people seem to understand. And so we started out with, I did a book that had to do with modular calling. I did it in 75, 76. I did a second one, and then we picked up on this one. Dancing for Busy People is a co-authorship, and it's really the pooling of the knowledge of three people, myself, Ken Kernan, and Bob Howell. We figured out this 100 and some years of dancing experience of the book. There are 400 plus dances in that book that cover the range of square dancing and contra dancing, trios, miscellances, solo dances, mixers, miscellaneous things we couldn't put in any particular category. It all fits within the Color Lab recommended basics with two exceptions. The three of us got together and agreed that, number one, Weave the Ring was just a variation on Right Nut Grand. And we felt that for contras, we needed to have Wheel Around, because it's an essential part of what you do when you promenade down in fours. I mean, you can't get away without either a Wheel Around or a California Twirl, and the two, Wheel Around was the more acceptable. The second one we put in just because we felt we needed it was Star Through. But otherwise, and for that, it fits within the Color Lab recommended set. It's designed for several purposes. It's designed as a resource material for dance leaders to take out in a recreational environment. For me, probably the more important use is it's designed as a textbook at the college level. I taught a college course on that this year for the first time. I'm a college professor now, part-time. And I taught my first course with the book this year. It worked out very well. I have also the teaching course that's a supplement to that, that people can have if they want to do it. But this is what I hope will be the wellspring for some courses in college that will eventually, hopefully, generate clubs in college. And out of the clubs in college, there will be people who will want to learn how to do this, and they can do it. One of the reasons for this is when I first learned how to call, As a young college student, we got a record. We picked up Setsunori's 5 Years of Dancing, the old Yeller manual. I've got a copy of it here I brought with me for the lecture tomorrow. There had to be a source where we could go for written material. And 5 years of square dancing was it. And I don't presume to say there's anywhere near the amount of knowledge there was in that 5 years book. But there's a good source there. And if people will go and use it, Bob, they've got material. If they want to use just that book forever, I wouldn't encourage it. But, you know, there's so much else out there besides that book. But, you know, that's a compilation of a little bit of a great huge pool. But it's an example so that people can go and pick up a source and find out that source is, an entry place into a world of unlimited entertainment. You know, I told the people today in one of the sessions that I was doing, I said, the thing that you folks have to realize in order to start this process is the number of terms that you know has nothing to do with the fun in dancing. That in the hands of a good imaginative leader, you don't need many terms to have a ball. And that's what that book is. Ken Kernan did mainly. Ken's contribution is Ken is extremely good in square dance calling. He is very imaginative. He did a tremendous amount of research. A lot of figures came from him. Bob Howe on solo dancing and the little odd formations is good. I can't really tell you where all the contributions, they came out of all three. You know, my major contribution was the fact I'm the wordsmith, can sit there and hammer out the words and do the grunt work to put it together. Wells in Denver.
So this concluded another interesting story. The life of Cal Campbell from Colorado, Castle Rock, Colorado. And again, we chatted for about an hour after the taping ended, and it was a very interesting evening.